Today, I am going to teach you a secret tool called stealth stoicism. This is a method you can use when you start your own journey on stoicism. This way of doing things lets you get the benefits of stoicism while also getting along with your friends, family, neighbors, and co-workers without getting teased or misunderstood. And here's something interesting. Many stoic practices can be easily and unnoticeably incorporated into your daily life. Mastering the art of constructive negative thinking, for example, can be your unseen friend, giving you strength from the inside out. Friends, relatives, neighbors, and co-workers may notice a difference in you if your practice of stoicism is good. The transformation, however, will likely be difficult for them to understand. If they come up to you confused and ask what your secret is, you could tell them the dirty truth. You're a hidden stoic. My next piece of advice for those who want to become stoics is to start with one method and work your way up to the others. Once you're good at it, move on to the next one. I think that negative thinking is a good way to start. Make it a point to think about losing whatever you value in life when you have free time. A dramatic transformation in your view on life can result from engaging in such reflection. Almost regardless of your circumstances, it can make you understand how fortunate you are and how much you have to be thankful for. My personal experience has taught me that negative thinking is like salt for cooking. The taste of almost any food a cook adds salt to will be improved as a result, even though it only takes a small amount of time, effort, and talent. In a similar vein, those who engage in negative visualization will find that their capacity to enjoy life is greatly increased, despite the fact that it takes little time, energy, and talent. Some people who do negative thinking end up loving the life they were complaining wasn't worth living just a short time before. But in my practice of stoicism, I've discovered that it's simple to forget to do negative meditation and, as a result, to go for days or even weeks without doing so. I believe I know why this happens. We increase our satisfaction with our circumstances by participating in negative visualization. But once you feel satisfaction, it's only normal to simply enjoy life. There is no way that someone who is happy with their life would spend time thinking about the bad things that could happen. That being said, the Stoics would tell us that negative visualization can help us let go of the things we value, as well as make us respect what we do have. So, negative thinking is just as important when things are going well as it is when things are going badly. As part of the bedtime meditation I read about in chapter 8, I tried making it a habit to imagine bad things every night before bed, but the experiment didn't work. My problem is that, as soon as my head hits the pillow, I end up falling asleep very quickly. Simply put, there is not enough time to picture it. It's now a habit of mine to do negative visualization and basically evaluate my progress as a stoic while I'm driving to work. I turn empty time into well-spent time by doing this. A beginner stoic should continue to practice applying the trichotomy of control, which is discussed in chapter 5, after learning negative visualization. The Stoics said that we should sort things into three groups: those that we have no control over, those that we have full control over, and those that we have some control over, but not full control over. Now that we know the difference, we should pay attention to the last two groups. When we worry about things we can't change, we waste time and add unnecessary anxiety to our lives. In addition to helping me manage my own anxieties, I've discovered that applying the trichotomy of control is a good way to tolerate the anxieties of the non-Stoics around me, whose anxieties might otherwise interfere with my tranquility. When relatives and friends tell me what's making them anxious, it often turns out that the things they're worried about are out of their control. What can you do about this situation? Nothing. Then why are you worrying about it? It's out of your hands. This way, I show them that worrying is useless. I sometimes add a quote from Marcus Aurelius after this last comment. Nothing is worth doing pointlessly. It is interesting that most of the people I have tried this on, even if I were to say they were prone to anxiety, responded to the logic of the trichotomy of control. If only for a short while, their anxiety is gone. You should practice internalizing your goals as a stoic beginner in order to become skilled at applying the trichotomy of control. Let's say your goal is not to win a tennis match. Instead, make it your goal to do your best in the match and prepare as well as you can. If you regularly think about your goals, you can lessen, but probably not get rid of, the feeling that you have failed to reach a goal, which would otherwise be a major source of stress in your life. In your Stoicism practice, you should also become a psychological fatalist about the past and the present, but not about the future. This is in addition to applying the trichotomy of control. You will be ready to think about the past and present in order to learn things that can help you better deal with the hurdles to end your way in tranquility, but you will not want to waste time having pointless thoughts about the past and present. Because you can't change the past or the present, you will understand that it is pointless to wish they were different. You are going to do your best to accept the past for what it was and enjoy the present for what it is. In our fight for tranquility, other people are our enemy, as we have seen. The Stoics spent a lot of time coming up with tactics for dealing with this enemy, especially tactics for dealing with the insults of people we hang out with. My transformation into an insult connoisseur from someone who feared insults has been one of the most fascinating aspects of my practice of Stoicism. One thing is that I've started to gather insults. When I'm hurt, I think about it and put it into a category. Along those lines, I enjoy being insulted because it gives me a chance to improve my insulting skills. It may sound strange, but one effect of practicing Stoicism is looking for chances to use Stoic methods. What I have more to say about this will be below. One thing that makes insults difficult to handle is that they typically come as a surprise. You're having a nice conversation with someone when suddenly he says something that could easily be taken as an insult, even if it wasn't meant to be. Not long ago, I was talking to a co-worker about the book he was writing. He told me that he would comment on some political writing I had done in this book. I was glad he knew about my work and was going to talk about it. Then there was the put down. "I'm trying to decide," he stated, "whether in my response to what you have written, I should categorize you as evil or merely misguided." Keep in mind that these kinds of comments are normal for educators. We have a terrible habit of fighting. If people know about our work, we want them to respect it and, even better, agree with the opinions we've come to. The problem is that our co-workers want the same respect and praise from us. As a result, scholars often get into vocal fights on college campuses everywhere. The use of put-downs and insults is common. This insult would have hurt me when I wasn't so calm, and I would have likely gotten angry. I would have fought hard to defend my work and done everything I could to respond to the insult. But that day, because I had been influenced by the Stoics, I was smart enough to react to this insult in a way that was stoically acceptable, by making fun of myself. "Why can't you portray me as being both evil and misguided?" I wanted to know. When someone insults me, I usually respond with humor that makes fun of myself. When someone criticizes me, I tell them that things are even worse than they seem. When someone says I'm lazy, for example, I tell them it's a wonder I get any work done at all. If someone says I have a big ego, I tell them that most days I don't even realize there are other people on the world until noon. You might think that these kinds of reactions are pointless because they make the person who insulted me look good. To the person who insults me, these answers make it clear that I believe in myself enough that I can't be hurt by his comments. It makes me laugh to think about them. In addition, by refusing to play the insult game and not responding to an insult with another insult, I make it clear that I think like that kind of behavior is beneath me. If I don't insult back, it's more likely to make the person who insulted me mad than if I did. Getting angry at other people is one of the worst things we can do. After all, our tranquility will be severely hampered by the anger. The Stoics understood that anger can ruin our life if we let it, and that it is anti-joy. As a result of paying close attention to my feelings, I've discovered a few things about anger. First, I'm fully aware of how much my anger has a life of its own. It can sleep for a while, like a bug, and then wake up and make me unhappy when I least expect it. For example, I might be trying to clear my mind of thoughts during yoga class when suddenly I get angry about a previous incident. Seneca was mistaken in saying that there is no pleasure in experiencing anger. I've come to the conclusion. That's the problem with anger. Letting it out feels good, but holding it in feels bad. Yes, it does feel great to let off steam and tell the person who hurt us how angry we are when our anger is justified and we are sure that we are right and they are wrong. To put it another way, anger is like a bug bite. It's unpleasant to not scratch the bite, but it's satisfying to do so. Of course, the problem with mosquito bites is that you usually feel bad about scratching them afterward. By scratching the bite, you increase the likelihood that it will get infected, and the itching comes back stronger. This is also true for anger. Letting it out feels good at the time, but you will probably regret it later. It's one thing to let off steam, or, even better, fake anger, in order to get someone to change how they act. Anger does make people act. However, I've discovered that these explanations don't cover a lot of the anger event. Sometimes when I'm driving my car, I get angry at other drivers who don't pay attention. I feel justified in my anger. I even yell at them sometimes. Both my and the other driver's windows are down, so they can't hear me. As a result, they can't react to my anger by promising not to do what made me mad again in the future. Even though this anger is right, it has no point at all. I only disturb my own tranquility by venting. In other instances, despite being rightfully angry at someone, I am unable to do so due to the circumstances. This is why I'm having bad thoughts about him instead. To say it again, these angry feelings are useless. They disturb me, but they don't bother the person I'm angry not at all. Indeed, if anything, they make the harm he does to me worse. What a waste of time. To add to that, I've found that following Stoicism has helped me get along better with other drivers. I'm not going to yell as much as I used to. Some bad thoughts I have about people who hurt me a long time ago have also gone away. When I do have bad thoughts, they don't last as long as they used to. Our anger will be difficult to control because it has these traits, can lie dormant inside of us, and feels good to let it out. One of the hardest things for a Stoic practitioner to do is learn how to deal with it. But I've learned that it's easier to control my anger when I think about it and try to understand it better. I happened to read Seneca's article on anger while I was waiting for my doctor. I was forced to wait in the waiting room for almost an hour because the doctor was significantly behind schedule. I had every reason to be mad, and I probably would have been mad before I became Stoic. But I couldn't get angry at that hour because I was thinking about being angry. I've also found that using comedy as a defense or gain of anger is quite beneficial. One great thing that helps me stay calm when I'm angry is to imagine I'm a character in an absurdist play. It's not supposed to make sense. Everyone isn't supposed to be smart. Sometimes justice does happen, but only by chance. Instead of having things make me angry, I tell myself to laugh at them. In fact, I try to imagine how the made-up absurdist writer could have made things even stranger. I'm sure Seneca was on point when he said that the best way to deal with things that make us cry is to laugh about them. Seneca also says that someone who can't hold back their laughter is smarter than someone who can't hold back their tears. Because laughing lets out the mildest feelings and shows that life doesn't have anything important, serious, or bad about it. As we have seen, the Stoics advised us to cause bad things to happen as a result of choosing to be uncomfortable. They also advised us to imagine bad things happening to us. For example, Seneca tells us to sometimes live as if we were poor, and Musō Ginnayus tells us to do things that make us feel bad. You need to be more self-disciplined to follow this advice than to follow the other Stoic methods. So, experienced Stoics should be the ones to do programs of voluntary pain. I have tried a method of choosing to be uncomfortable. The idea of going barefoot by Musonia didn't work for me, but I have tried less extreme things, like not dressing appropriately for winter and not heating or cooling my car in the winter or summer. Along with that, I've started going to yoga classes. Yoga has made me more balanced and flexible, told me how important play is, and made me very aware of how little power I have over what's going on in my mind. But besides these and other benefits, yoga has turned into a great way for me to choose to be uncomfortable. Some of the poses I do in yoga are painful, or very close to being painful. Bending my legs just until they start to cramp is one way I do it. Then I take a step back. But my yoga teacher never talks about pain. Instead, she talks about poses that make me feel too much. Although it is physically impossible, if what I am experiencing is, say, a leg cramp, she has taught me how to breathe into the area that hurts. Still, there's no doubt that the method works. Rowing is another thing that can be painful, but it can also be a source of fun and entertainment. I learned how to row a racing shell soon after I started practicing Stoicism, and I've since started racing against other people. In the summer, we rowers have to deal with heat and humidity. In the spring and fall, we have to deal with cold wind and sometimes even snow. We get hit with water every once in a while. First, we get blisters, then calluses. One of the best things that serious rowers do when they're not on the water is shave off their calluses. Along with being painful for the body, rowing is a great way to be painful emotionally. Rowing has given me a list of fears to get over. The race shells I row are very unsteady. If they get the chance, they will happily throw a rower into the water. By successfully surviving three flips, it took me a lot of effort to get over my fear of flipping. As time went on, I got over other fears, like rowing in the dark before dawn, taking off from the dock while standing up in the boat, and being in the middle of a lake hundreds of yards from the nearest shore in a small boat that has let me down three times. You are likely to experience butterflies in your stomach whenever you engage in an activity in which public failure is a chance. As I said before, since I became a Stoic, I've become a collector of insults. I also now have a lot of butterflies. Simply so I can practice dealing with these butterflies, I like to participate in activities like competitive rowing that make me feel anxious. After all, they are a big part of the fear of failure. I am overcoming my fear of failure by dealing with them. I experience some beautiful butterflies in the hours before a race. They make me focus on the race that's coming up, so I do my best to use them to my advantage. I get the pleasure of watching butterflies fly away once a race has started. I have also looked in other places for butterflies. I chose to learn how to play an instrument, which was something I had never done before after I started following Stoicism. What I picked to play was the banjo. My teacher asked me if I wanted to participate in the concert that his students put on after several months of lessons. At first, I said no to the offer. It didn't sound fun at all to try to play the banjo in front of a bunch of strangers and risk being embarrassed. Then it occurred to me that this was a great chance to make myself feel bad and face my fear of failing in the hopes of getting rid of it. I agreed to join in. I had never experienced anything as stressful as the performance. It's not that I have a fear of crowds. I can walk into a classroom of 60 kids I've never met and start teaching them without any anxiety. But this wasn't like that. I had the experience of seeing butterflies the size of little bats before my show. Plus, I went into a different mental state where time seemed to bend and the rules of physics stopped applying of its own. To make a long story short, I made it through the performance. The butterflies I experienced while participating in a regatta or playing the banjo are, of course, a sign of anxiety. And it might seem contrary to Stoic values to deliberately induce anxiety in myself. In fact, if one of the goals of Stoicism is to achieve tranquility, then shouldn't I do everything in my power to avoid things that cause me anxiety? Should I not be collecting butterflies but running away from them? Not in the least. I have stopped a lot of future anxiety from happening in my life by making myself nervous by doing things like having a banjo recital. I can now use a great piece of reasoning to show that this new problem is nothing compared to the banjo performance when I face it. I got through that task, so I'm sure I can get through this one too. In other words, by participating in the performance, I protected myself from a fair amount of future anxiety. Anyway, it's just a vaccine that won't last forever, so I need to get another dose of butterflies to do it again. I see myself, or at least a part of me, as an opponent in a game when I do things that hurt my body and mind. This enemy, who I think of as my other self, is on evolving standby. Nothing is more important to him than being at ease and taking advantage of any chances for pleasure that may present themselves. One of my other selves is not self-disciplined. Ignoring the rules, he will always choose the easiest way through life, turning into a simple-minded pleasure seeker as a result. He's also a fool. To use Epictetus's words, my other self is not my friend. Instead, I should see him as an enemy, waiting to win points in a battle with my other self. I need to show him that I am in charge. To accomplish this, I must make him experience pain he could have easily escaped and keep him from experiencing pleasures he might have otherwise liked. I must make him face and get over his fears when he doesn't want to do something. Why do I have to play this game against myself? To gain some self-discipline, as one reason. Also, why is it worth having self-discipline? Those who have it have the power to choose what they do with their life. If you don't have self-discipline, someone or something else will decide your way through life. As a result, there is a very real chance that you'll miss living. I grow as a person when I play the game against my other self. Building character is something that makes people laugh these days, but the Stoics would have wholeheartedly supported it and recommended it to anyone wishing to live a good life. Playing the game against my past self is also fun, which is another reason I do it. In this game, getting a point by doing something like getting over a fear is a lot of fun. The Stoics knew this, and Epictetus, as we saw in chapter 7, talks about how good it is to deny ourselves different kinds of pleasure. In the same way, Seneca tells us that we will be proud of ourselves when we reach the end of something bad. Some people think I'm competing against the other rowers when I row, but I'm really competing against my other self, which is much more important. He did not wish to learn how to row. If he could choose, he would rather spend the hours before dawn sleeping in a warm bed. He didn't wish to row to the race's starter line. Indeed, he complained over and over about how tired he was on the way there, and during the race, he wanted to give up rowing and simply let the other rowers win. As if to tempt her, he would say, "All this pain would end if you just stopped rowing. Why not just give up? Just picture how good it will feel." It's interesting that the people who are competing with me in the race of simplification are also my partners in the much more important battle against my other self. When we race against each other, we are all running against ourselves at the same time, even if some of us aren't aware of it. Each of us must get past our own fears, laziness, or lack of self-discipline to race against the other rowers. It is possible for someone to lose the race against the other rowers, to come in last place, but to have won the fight against this other self in the process. As we've seen, the Stoics advocate for programs of volunteer suffering to help people simplify their way of life. As I said, simplifying your life is something that only mature Stoics should do. It's likely that a new Stoic will want to stay out of the intellectual spotlight. People will notice if you start dressing less. Also, people will notice if you keep driving the same old car or, shudder, quit driving and ride a bike or take the bus instead. People will always assume the worst, whether it's going to end in debt or even the beginning of a mental illness. Furthermore, telling them that you have given up trying to impress people who aren't interested in how someone looks will only make things worse. It took some getting used to when I started feeling ashamed and tried living a simpler life. When someone asked me where I got the t-shirt I was wearing, I found myself feeling a little embarrassed when I replied that I got it at a thrift store. I now respect Cato's approach to dealing with such feelings because of this incident. As we've seen, Cato dressed in different ways to train. He wanted to learn to feel bad about only the things that were bad. So, he went out of his way to do things that would make him feel bad about himself, simply so he could practice getting over those feelings. Recently, I've been trying to be like Cato in this way. My goals have changed a lot since I became a Stoic. I don't want many of the things I used to think were necessary for life. After a while, my clothes have become more practical than the fancy ones I used to wear. If you need me to, I can put on a tie and a sport coat. Luckily, they aren't needed very often. I used to want a new car, but when my 16-year-old car died, I traded it in for a 9-year-old one, which I couldn't imagine doing 10 years ago. One thing my old car didn't have was a cup holder, and the radio didn't work. The new car does. What happiness. I used to understand why someone would want to own a Rolex watch. Now this kind of action confuses me. It used to be that I didn't have enough money to do anything with. Now I do. A big part of the reason is that I don't need many of the things that money can buy. I read that a lot of people in the United States are having a hard time with money. Their bad habit is to use up all their available credit, and if that doesn't meet their need for consumer goods, they keep spending money anyway. If only they had the capacity to enjoy life's simple joys, many of these people, one thinks, would be wealthy rather than bankrupt and much happier. I am no longer able to operate as a customer. Like, I don't buy anything when I go to the mall. I look around instead and am amazed by all the things for sale that I not only don't need, but also can't imagine having. I only find entertainment in malls by watching other people. My guess is that most of them don't go to the mall because they need to buy something. More than that, they go to the mall hoping that it will make them want something they didn't want before. It could be a need for a new phone, a wool sweater, or a set of socket tools. Why do they go out of their way to make you want something? Because if they make someone want something, they can enjoy the rush that comes from giving in to that desire and getting what it wants. Of course, it's just a rush that doesn't have much to do with their long-term happiness, just like an addict's hit doesn't have much to do with their long-term happiness. After saying that, I should add that the reason I don't have many markets wants isn't because I'm trying to stop them from coming up. On the other hand, these kinds of wants to have simply stopped coming into my head, or at least not nearly as frequently as they used to. To put it another way, I don't seem to be able to desire market things as much as I used to. What caused things to get this way? The deep realization brought on by Stoicism that getting the things that people in my social circle usually want and work hard to buy will, in the long run, make no difference in how happy I am and will in no way add to my having a good life. I am certain that I would experience no more joy than I do now, and I might even experience less if I were to buy a new car, a nice outfit, a Rolex watch, and a bigger house. Being a customer, I feel like I've crossed some kind of great divide. After crossing that line, I don't think I'll ever be able to go back to the mindless shopping that I used to enjoy so much. An unexpected side effect. Now I'll talk about an unexpected side effect of stoicism. By doing things like negative imagery or purposefully making yourself uncomfortable, a stoic will constantly be getting ready for hardship. A strange kind of sadness might set in if hardship doesn't come after that point. You might find yourself wishing that your stoicism were put to the test so that you could see if you really do have the skills you've worked so hard to develop for dealing with hardship. In other words, you're like a firefighter who has trained for years but has never been asked to put out a real fire, or like a football player who practices hard all season but has never been put in a game. In this vein, scholar Paul Vane has made the comment that if we try to live a stoic life, a calm life is unsettling because we don't know if we would be strong in a storm. Additionally, Seneca said that if someone tries to hurt a wise man, the wise man might even accept it because the harm can only help him. He doesn't run away from bad circumstances or people. In fact, he sees harm as a good thing, because it forces him to prove his goodness. Seneca also says that a stoic might look forward to death because it is the final test of his stoicism present. I have discovered in myself a desire to have my stoicism tested, even though I have not been following stoicism for very long. I've already said that I want to be attacked. I want to see if I can handle insults in a way that is stoically fitting. To see if I can pass these tests, I have also gone out of my way to put myself in situations that test my guts and willpower. An incident that occurred while I was writing this book helped me understand why the Stoics wanted to be tried on their stoicism. When I blinked my eyes in a dark room, I saw flashes of light around the edges of my field of vision. This is when the incident started. At the eye doctor's office, I was told that I had a torn retina and that I needed laser surgery to keep it from coming off. The nurse who got me ready for surgery told me that the doctor would use a powerful laser beam to hit my retina repeatedly. She asked me if I had ever seen a light show and said what I was about to see was much more spectacular than that. The doctor then started zapping me as soon as he entered the room. The first bursts of light were very bright and beautiful, but then something strange happened. The light bursts stopped appearing to me. I still heard the laser go off, but I didn't see anything. After the laser was turned off, the only thing I could see out of the eye that had been operated on was a purple blob that took up the whole field of vision. Someone might have messed up the surgery, like the laser might not have worked right, and I might now be blind in one eye as a result. Of course, this thought was disturbing, but after I had it, I had another completely different idea. Thinking about how I would act if I lost one eye made me feel sad. One more thing. Would I be able to handle it in a stoic way? So, in response to the thought that I might lose an eyesight, I thought about how it might affect the stoic test. You might think this answer is strange. It seemed strange to me, and it still does. Regardless, this is what I said. It seems that by reacting this way, I was experiencing a normal, and some might even say strange, side effect of practicing stoicism. I told the nurse that I couldn't see out of the eye that had surgery. Finally, she told me that this was normal and that my sight would return in an hour. Why hadn't she told me that before? As a result, I was happily denied the chance to have my stoicism put to the test unless I die too soon. About 10 years from now, I will face a big test of my stoicism. I will be coming up on 60 years old or on the verge of old age. As I've gone through life, I've looked for role models, people who I thought were doing well in the next stage of their lives. When I was 50, I started looking at the 70 and 80-year-olds I knew to find someone to look up to. I discovered that it was simple to locate individuals in that age range who could be bad examples. I thought that my goal should be to not end up like them. Positive role models, on the other hand, were hard to come by. When I asked the 70 and 80-year-olds I knew for advice on dealing with the onset of old age, they all had the same annoying tendency to say, "Don't get old. The only way I can follow this advice is to kill myself." After some time, I realized that they were telling me to do this, albeit in a roundabout way. Miss On said, "He who dies not late, but well, is blessed." Their advice not to get old makes me think of that. Some older people I know have come to the same conclusion. Not existing is better than getting old. This could happen to me too when I'm in my 70s or 80s. But it's also possible that many people who find old age so hard are to blame for their situation. As kids, they didn't do anything to get ready for old age. Some people think that they might not have found old age so hard if they had taken the time to properly prepare themselves and had started following Stoicism in particular. He said it was one of the most enjoyable times of life, and they might have agreed. If they knew how to use it, it is a stage that is full of pleasure. Stroke. My 88-year-old mother had a stroke while I was writing this book. As it happened, I sent her to a nursing home. She could no longer get out of bed by herself because the stroke had made her left side so weak. In addition, she had trouble swallowing, making it risky for her to eat and drink normal food and liquids because they could get stuck in her throat and cause asthma, which can be deadly. The foods and drinks she was given had to be blended or thickened. I discovered that there is a whole line of thickened drinks that have been developed for people who have a drinking problem. It was easy to see why my mom was unhappy with the way her life had changed, and I tried my best to cheer her up. If I were very religious, I might have tried to make her feel better by praying with her or for her, or by telling her that I had gotten tens or even hundreds of people to pray for her. I did find, though, that the most encouraging things I could say sounded very stoical. She would tell me, for instance, how difficult her situation was, and I would quote Marcus. "Yes, they say that life is more like wrestling than like dancing." She would ask herself what she needed to do to walk again. I wasn't going to tell her that I didn't think she would ever walk again. Instead, I told her to think about her walking goals on a daily basis without giving her a lesson on stoicism. She would complain that she had lost most of the use in her left arm, and I would tell her, "What you need to focus on is doing your very best when they give you physical therapy." I would then tell her to do negative visualization. It was something I would remind her of. "At least you can talk. In the days after the stroke, you could only mumble. You couldn't even move your right arm, so you couldn't feed yourself. But now you can. Really, you have a lot to be thankful for." She would listen to my response and, after a moment of thought, usually agree with me. I suppose I do. The negative visualization practice seemed to help her feel better, even if it was only for a short time. There were many times during this time when I was struck by how natural and right it is to use Stoic principles to help someone deal with the problems that come with getting older and being sick. My mother shouldn't drink normal, unthickened water because of the stroke, as I previously stated, ice. Being told she couldn't have water made her automatically start to want it. In a weak voice, she would beg me to get her a glass of plain water from the sink, not thickened. If they asked, I would say no and explain why. But as soon as I was done explaining, she would ask again, "Just a glass of water, please." I felt like a loving son who kept turning down his old mother's request for a simple glass of water. I finally gave in to my mom's pleading and asked the nurse what to do in the end. She said, "Give her ice cubes to suck on." As a result of this advice, I became my mother's personal iceman. The water in the ice will be released slowly, so there is little danger that she will aspirate it. "The iceman cometh," I would call out as I walked into her room each time, bringing a cup with me. She would tell me how great the ice was as she sucked on it while I put it in her mouth. My mother, who had once been a fan of fine food and drink, had now become one of ice cubes, which she had taken for granted her entire life. For her, an ice cube was just something you put in a drink to cool it down. Worth drinking gave her a lot of pleasure right now. It was clear that she liked this ice more than a foodie would enjoy old champagne. I felt a little envious as I watched her happily suck on ice cubes. As I thought this, wouldn't it be great to get this much pleasure from a simple ice cube? I decided that negative thinking probably wouldn't be enough to make me love ice cubes as much as my mom does. It looks like a stroke like hers would be needed to fix things. Watching her suck on ice cubes, however, has been very educational. It made me aware of something else I take for granted: being able to drink a big glass of cold water on a hot summer day. Ghost. When I went to see my mom one time, I saw the ghost of Christmas future. I was going to my mom's room by walking down the hall of the nursing home. A man in a wheelchair who was being pushed by a helper was in front of me. The assistant caught my attention when I got close and pointed to her charge, saying, "This man is a professor." It turned out that my mother had been telling everyone about me. I stopped to say hello to this other professor, who had already retired. We talked for a while, but the whole time I couldn't help but think that I might have this conversation again in a few decades. Then I would be in the wheelchair, and a younger professor would be standing in front of me, taking a break from his busy day to talk to an old professor. I told myself, my time is coming, and I need to do everything I can to get ready. The goal of my progress. Stoicism, as we have seen, is the pursuit of tranquility. Readers will naturally want to know whether or not my own practice of Stoicism has helped me achieve this goal. It has, however, resulted in my being significantly more tranquil than was formerly the case. Having said that, I should add that although I may have tamed my negative emotions, I have not eradicated them, nor is it likely that I ever will. Nevertheless, I am delighted to have deprived these emotions of some of the power they used to have over me. I have learned something else about joy through my practice of Stoicism. The Stoics were interested in a type of happiness that is best described as a pleasure that isn't based on a specific thing, but on everything. Simply being able to participate in life is an absolute joy. This understanding that everything doesn't have to be possible is a deep one. It is wonderful, beautifully possible. To be clear, practicing Stoicism has not given me the ability to experience constant joy. I also haven't experienced the higher kind of joy that a Stoic teacher might experience, the kind of joy that comes from knowing that outside events can't change his happiness. But practicing Stoicism seems to have made me more likely to have occasional bursts of happiness over all of this. It's strange, but I wasn't sure what to make of these outbursts when I first started experiencing them. Should I let go of my happy feelings or hold on to them? So, as a sober adult, should I actually try to put them out? Since then, I've discovered that I'm not the only one who is wary of happy feelings. Then it hit me. It would be an absolute waste of time to do anything but welcome them. That's why I have. I realized that these comments make me sound disgustingly cocky and happy with myself. You don't have to go around telling everyone how happy they are to be living or about the recent bursts of joy they've been experiencing in order to practice Stoicism, rest assured. In fact, the Stoics would have probably told people not to do that. So why am I telling you about how I feel? Because it answers the question you naturally want to know: does Stoicism do what it says it will do for your mental health? This was the case for me, and it worked more than well enough. After making this point, though, I will do my best to be incredibly humble in the future when I talk about my mental health in public. As I wrap up, regrets, Stoic. I have to say that I'm not sure about the philosophy. The Stoics say that if I want tranquility, I have to give up other goals that someone in my circumstances might have, like owning a fancy new car or living in a $1 million house. What if these people are wrong and everyone else is right? It's possible that I will be confused and sad when I think back on what I will then call my stoic phase. I'm going to ask myself, what was I thinking? I'm not the only stoic who thinks, if only I could have those years back. For example, in his article on tranquility, Seneca makes up a talk with Serenus, a stoic who has doubts about stoicism. Serenus writes, "Been among people with normal values, for example, after he has dined in a house where one even tread on precious stones and riches are scattered about in every corner, he discovers within himself a secret sting and the doubt whether the other life is not better." The comments above make it clear that I, too, have experienced this secret sting. Happiness is much more valuable than fame and money, and there are a lot more people who think that than there are who think that tranquility is more valuable. Are all of these other people mistaken? Surely, I'm the one who is wrong. On the other hand, I know from my study on desire that almost all philosophers and religious thinkers who have thought about life and how people usually live, it have come to the conclusion that most people are living their lives wrong. Though many of them disagreed with the Stoics on how to best achieve tranquility, these thinkers also tended to see it as something very much worth seeking. When I start having second thoughts about Stoicism, I remind myself that only numbers can provide absolute truth. In other words, there are times when everything you do could be wrong. This means that it's possible for me to be wrong about following Stoicism, but it's also possible for me to be wrong about giving up Stoicism in favor of a different philosophy of life. Another big mistake that I see a lot of people making is not having any kind of philosophy of life. Following the cues of their genetic training, these people feel their way through life by avoiding what feels bad and seeking out what feels good. They might have a happy life or even a life full of pleasure if they do this. Still, it's unclear whether they could have a better life if they went against their evolutionary training and instead spent time and effort learning a philosophy of life. If you ask the Stoics, they will say that there is a better life that is possible. It might have less comfort and pleasure, but a lot more joy. If I live that long, I think that any doubts I may have had about Stoicism will go away as I get older. Stoic techniques can make your life better when things are going well, but it's when things are going badly that you can really see how well they work. In my eighth or ninth decade of life, if I find Stoicism to be helpful in my sixth decade, I will probably find it to be essential. Unless I'm a very strange person, the hardest parts of my life are still to come. Before these tests are given, I think I will be glad to have learned about and appreciated Stoicism. There should be proof that Stoicism or some other philosophy of life is the right one. The Stoics' proof doesn't really make their point, and it's not likely that another proof will come up soon. We must act based on possibilities in the absence of such a proof. There are many reasons to believe that Stoicism is worth a try for a particular type of person, in particular circumstances, and with particular personality types. Stoicism doesn't require a lot of effort. In fact, it requires a lot less effort than what one would waste in the absence of a life philosophy. Someone can practice Stoicism and no one will know, and they can do it for a while and then stop, and they won't be worse off for it. In other words, there isn't much to lose by trying Stoicism as a philosophy of life, and there could be a lot to gain from doing so. Marcus actually says that you can gain a whole new life by practicing Stoicism.